Just before we launch into the questions, I remember I forgot to mention something. My last point was about telling Jesus as a story, and I forgot to tell you about all the resources that are out there for it. So I learnt the storytelling technique from other missionaries who are using the storytelling technique. And one missionary in particular, her name is Christine Dillon. So it would be very wrong for me not to mention her name. And she has written a book. So just Google her name. She's got a book. I think it's called Storytelling the Gospel. It's by IVP. She's also got a Facebook page you can try to get yourself into. It's called Storytelling the Scriptures. And everyone goes on. It's like a forum and shares their stories of using storytelling to tell the gospel. Or you can sign up for a Wycliffe Bible storytelling course. So many people have done that. And then just adapt it to suit yourself. I think the problem with Wycliffe is they make it sound like you better do it this way or it's the wrong way. But I think it's much more flexible than this. So I'll share with you my storytelling experiences. Once a year I'm on a Crusader ski camp. We ski all morning with the teenagers. At lunch we're in this crowded, steamy lodge for lunch. And I'm meant to give a Bible talk in this environment. And then they go skiing again. Then they have a Bible study time. And so I can either go into my usual Katoomba introduction, three-point conclusion thing at lunchtime, but instead I use storytelling, and it has worked every time for the last 4 or 5 years I've done it. And the non-Christians get really excited on the lift. They're always trying to talk to me about the story, and then also saying, what story are we going to do next? What story are we going to do next? So it really engages non-Christians, the storytelling technique. But again, it's not a silver bullet. I don't want you to feel like, oh, okay, this way we really work. But I'll share another experience. So some missionaries from China were back in Sydney on a break, and so they started reaching out to Chinese university and MBA students. And there's a real hunger in the Asians for Jesus right now. And so if you notice, if you go to any university campus, the Christian groups are like 99% Asian. You go to Timothy Keller's church in New York, it's almost all Asian. And you think, oh, okay, that's why it's working. You're working with Asians. You're really running an Asian church in disguise. Anyone can get a big church if it's an Asian church. So then they slowly invited these university students to come to someone's house for dinner. So it's always hospitality. And uni students always want food. They always need food. And then before dinner, it's what Asians call steamboat, hot pot, sort of meal. But before the meal started, someone got up and story told the creation story, Genesis 1 and 2. And then someone story told the fall, Genesis 3. Someone story told Cain and Abel, Genesis 4, because this is what they had done in the previous weeks, is to recap the newcomers. And then over dinner, over the meal, someone story told Genesis 6, 7, 8 and 9, the Noah and the flood story. And then we had discussion while we were eating. And we went from like 6 p.m. to, like, I had to leave at 11 p.m., but it was just going on and on and on. So again, it was hospitality and storytelling. It just seems to be a really easy way of getting our non-Christian friends talking about Jesus. And I was just sharing during the break that now when I reread the New Testament, I've noticed hospitality pops up a lot more than we thought it did. And then in the gifts of teaching, evangelism, is hospitality as well. It's one of the major word gifts. It's how the word gets out. It gives you the context for using the word gifts of teaching and evangelism. All right, any questions now, please? Yes?
For some of you might, say, get really exhausted from people.
Yeah.
They don't feel like they have a lot of time. They might be sitting here listening, oh, man, Sam's just like, he's constantly at 2,000, sharing the gospel. Like, what do you have to say to someone who's thinking that?
Yeah, so the question is, what do you say to people who get exhausted from being with people? And as I mentioned before, that is actually me. So my wife is a quiet extrovert. She gets energised from being with people. I'm a loud introvert. The longer I'm with people, the more I just feel myself fading. So at a party, we're always out of sync. I just want to get there early and leave early. She wants to get there late when it's pumping, and she's always the last one. Like, she's cleaning up, she's always the last one to leave. I'm like, oh, we're so out of sync. At church, I'm the one that wants to leave. I've had enough. She's always at the morning tea. I'm that guy that stands at the fence, like, looking like, come on. So I'm with you. I hear you. But I think we got to realise we just got to work with what we have. And so I think God gives us all in different ways, and we use our energy in different ways. And I don't know what the statistics are, but maybe 90% of us are introverts, I think. So I think it's the majority thing. So we just got to understand, one, okay, there will be times I need to be with people, but then I just need appropriate proportional quiet time to prepare and recover from that. So just be realistic. And also realize, and introverts have a way of finding each other as well. So then when we're with each other for the coffee, dinner, gospel, it's actually, they're very quiet spaces rather than loud spaces. So we tend to find each other and gravitate towards each other. So I remember one time at Bible college, at morning tea, I'm just sitting at a bench by myself. And then one of the students came up and sat next to me and he said, "You're an introvert, aren't you?" I said, "Oh, how do you know?" He said, "I've been watching you. I can tell. I can tell." And I said, "Are you an introvert as well?" He goes, "Yeah, I am." And then suddenly we're bonding. And I think we can find introverts to bond with then at parties or at things like that. But also knowing that will be times I have to give energy, but then I got to look for quiet time afterwards to recover or to recharge before.
But just like time as well. So like people feel busy.
Yeah.
Time to go to all my poor neighbours and give them a
bowl of wine. Yes, that's right. So the question was, what about time? Like, I don't have time to do all this. On the one hand, I'll give you an unrealistic picture because I've compressed my 10, 20, 30 years of evangelism experience into 1 hour. And you think, oh, dude, how do you do that? Well, I've got 30 years worth of anecdotes to give you 1 hour, so I'm giving you an unrealistic picture. But the time thing, I remember listening to a TED talk. They said time is always what is most urgent. So we never have time, we never have time, we never have time until the water pipe bursts. Now you've got to find a plumber and find 5 hours to fix these water pipes. Suddenly we find 5 hours. Because we had to get these water pipe fixed. And it's the same. So we think, okay, I want to invest time into my non-Christian network. I need to merge my universes. So I'm going to invest time into this. Like I said, it's like the decision, I'm going to get fit. I'm going to get fit. Well, you're going to need a lifestyle paradigm shift to make that happen. You're going to have to change everything about the way we wake up, sleep, watch TV, eat, drink, exercise. It's the same. So, okay, I want to be evangelistic, so I need to now have a lifestyle change where part of my life is I'm going to be watering the lawn on a Friday, you know, looking for another neighbour to chat with, and then I'm going to intentionally around Christmas and Easter just pop around and knock on houses. And you're right, it does take time. So last Christmas, I think we went to 10 houses and we started at 3 p.m. and it finished like at 7 p.m. by the time we'd done all 10 houses, because with each house you end up chatting for 20 minutes. But it really was, like, for me it's like, okay, let's do it. And then go, okay, let's go. Like, for me I had to really psych myself up for it. But it was only once or twice a year, and afterwards you recharge and go, wow, that went so much better than I thought it would. And you can make it fun, so I'll share with you how we made it fun. We got our three little boys dressed up in Santa hats and they had their presents in the sacks. It was a $200, $300 investment. You know, you do the maths, 10 neighbours, $20 presents, that's $200 we just lost. But I thought it's just once a year. And the cachet you get afterwards is amazing, as in the capital you've just built up with your neighbours. So one couple was a new couple. They said, wow, this has never happened in our whole lives before. We've lived in so many places. This has never happened on Christmas Day. And then, so then they invited themselves over a few days later, sat in our backyard for like 3 to 4 hours. And then now we're going to try to do double date nights with them. So maybe next week we'll do our first double date. So bit by bit. So then I think what keeps you going is there's a cost-benefit analysis. The cost is, I'm going to be so exhausted from this, but the benefits are what energize you. Because you actually see the benefits. You don't feel like it's wasteful. It feels purposeful. Yes.
Last year I started talking to men in their 30s.
Yes.
And I asked them, when was the last time you made a friend?
Yeah. Yes.
In Canberra. And the answer was generally more than 5 years ago.
Mm.
I was thinking about the kind of merge your friends with our friends. And I'm wondering whether you have any advice more foundationally on how does one make a friend?
Yeah, how does one make a friend? The question is, in your 30s, things seem to be different from in your 20s. Great New York Times article about 2 years ago on friendship, on just how your universes get smaller and smaller. So you know when you're 21, you have a 21st birthday party, there are 200 people you want to invite. Then at your wedding in your 30s, there might be 100 people you want to invite. Then at your 40th birthday, you just want 3 people at your party. And that's true. So your quantity is decreased, but your quality of your relationships change. So there are life stage appropriate things here on what's realistic and what's unrealistic in terms of number of friendships. So I think recognizing, well, what stage of life am I in? I'm in my 30s. I'm only going to have 5 or 10 meaningful friends, and these guys are only going to have 5 or 10 meaningful friends. So if I was to have a dinner party, it's not 20, 40 people I invite, it's 3 or 4 guys or families, 2 Christians, 2 non-Christians. That's what I'm doing, trying to make this network become a merged universe. So my universe is going to be much smaller because of my stage in life, but that's okay. That's a stage of life appropriate. And your universes naturally shrink. They say what makes friendships are frequent, unplanned interactions. So that's why when you leave a workplace, it's so hard to maintain a friendship because you're not having any frequent, unplanned interactions anymore. You have to plan your interactions, so that makes it hard. So again, being realistic, okay, what is going to have the most frequent, unplanned interactions? That's where I'm going to build my friendships. But especially for men, men in their 30s and 40s get incredibly lonely. So in that sense, it's easy to become the friend of someone, and then they start going through these incredible life challenges that no one prepared them for. So I turned 50 last year, but I found my 40s really hard, and I went through, I spoke at a church, and the minister asked me, I said, how's Bible college going? I said, oh, didn't you hear? I quit that job. And he said, you're having a midlife crisis, you and I need to have talk. And so I met him the next week, and he was right. I was having a midlife crisis. I'm thinking, how did you know? Because I went through one. Every man goes through a midlife crisis between 30 and 50. So I started trying to become an expert on it. I started reading all these books on men in their midlife crisis. Like, oh my gosh, this is a real thing. It's like a second adolescence. It's not a matter of if it happens, but when, and how equipped you are for when it happens. And so I start talking to nurses at work whose husbands are in their 30s and 40s, and I start asking them questions about their husbands. I said, your husband's having a midlife crisis. And they look at you like, how do you know? And I start telling them, see, now you become a guru, a de facto chaplain in their life, because you can read their husbands so well. And I have this theory that wisdom is now the entry point in evangelism. It used to be, you're a sinner, you're going to hell, you need salvation. Now I think wisdom, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, is our entry point into evangelism. If you can demonstrate wisdom, they go, dude, tell me more. And so then when I meet these men, I start talking to them in their 30s and 40s. How's your life going? How's your work going? Because I remember when I had my midlife crisis, I started explaining it to my go-to set of buddies. I have 3 or 4 buddies I go hang out with 3 or 4 times a year. And I said to them, guys, this is a real thing. Like, your job goes nowhere, you quit. And they said to me, that's what we've been trying to tell you about our lives the last 5 years. You just weren't listening. So they were going through it. I just wasn't tuned to it. So you don't notice a pram until you have to buy a pram. And so, you know, then when you have a midlife crisis, you notice every man. So for men in their 30s and 40s, I think that's the entry point. Start talking to them about their job, their family, their health. Because apparently you get trapped by 3 things: your work and your finances, your family and your health. You can't control your body like you used to. You put on a belly. I can't get rid of it no matter how much I run. I've got a family now. I'm trapped. I've got kids. I can't just walk away. And I've got a job and a mortgage, so I can't just walk away either. I have to pay the mortgage. So usually you crack in one or if not all 3 areas. You have the affair, you make an irresponsible financial purchase, or you quit your job. And so when I quit my job, one of my ministers said to me, oh, and I actually bought a Jeep, an irresponsible financial purchase. And I said, we were so glad it was a job in the Jeep and not the third one, the affair. But then having said that, so many of my friends and peers have had an affair. And so now I see it as not excusable, but I understand what was going on in their life when that happened. So I think that's the existential entry point for men in their 30s, 40s and 50s now. So it's a different existential entry point than when we were in our 20s. And the next thing I want to say is I've noticed with all the friends we've built up at AFL, and at the parents group, kids group, play group. Because we call it kids time, but that's our the play group. And other places, we've made a lot of friends. I've said to my wife, Steph, have you noticed something with all our friends? They're not from Sydney. They moved into Sydney in the last 2 to 5 years. They have no network of friends. We have become their go-to network of friends because they've only just moved into the city. So I guess that's where we can make quality friendships. Looking for people who've moved into the city with no other friends or family. I'll tell you, I came back after 5 years in Chicago. It took me 2 years before Sydney felt home again. And what I really, really missed was I didn't know anywhere to go to relax. What restaurant, what bar, what coffee shop do I go to? I didn't have any shows on TV, on the radio I knew I could listen to because I was listening to different stuff in America. And I had no one to ring on Friday night to hang out. And I think that's what all these people I've noticed are lacking. No Friday night hangout buddy. So for guys then, we can become their Friday night hangout buddy, especially people who have moved into the city in the last 2 years because they've got no Friday night hangout buddy. And then when you hang out, just show that you're taking an interest in their work, their family, and whatever else. And then slowly they'll say, wow, you've got a wisdom about you. What's going on? And I noticed a non-Christian neighbour on our street once said to me, you know, you, and there was another full-time Christian minister living on our street, you and that other guy, you guys always seem to have a wisdom about you. So you don't even know it, but as Christians, you pick up a wisdom, a worldly wisdom. In 1 Corinthians, worldly wisdom is seen as a bad thing, but in Proverbs, worldly wisdom is seen as a good thing. So we can have a worldly wisdom in a positive sense, which the world will notice. Yes, question.
Sure.
Yes.
Like some people I know love it and they just want to go and do it, and some people are scared to death and are really against it.
Yep.
What are your thoughts?
What are my thoughts on walk-up evangelism? I think God gifts us in different ways. So we can always work against our gifting, and that's good. Get out of our comfort zone. But at the same time, just realize God has wired us in certain ways and don't feel bad about that. So I'll give you an example. So I'm gifted in upfront talking. My wife is so not gifted at upfront talking. What she really hates is sometimes when we go to places, they want you to be the husband and the wife. She absolutely hates that. So on the one hand, I could say, hey, go against your gifting. You know, do something brave. But on the other hand, you know, it just absolutely kills her. Her gifting is the being available and being with people and opening up the home. That works really well with her. Me, despite all my stories of hospitality, like if I know we're having people over, I freak out. I absolutely freak out. I see how cluttered the house is. I say, well, we're not ready. My wife is so calm. So we still have people over, but it goes against my gifting and nature. Whereas my gifting and nature is upfront speaking. And believe it or not, my gifting and nature is not one-on-one evangelism. So when we do college mission, we're always having to do one-on-one walk-up. It seems to be what college mission is. You give testimonies and then do one-on-one. And I'm always paired up with someone and it never works. It never works. So I often try to pair up with a more expert person. So they say, okay, those who aren't very good, pair up with someone who's got experience. And so I line up in the inexperienced pool to be paired up with an experienced pool person. I remember this happened at Newcastle Uni. And they looked at me, oh, come on, you're a Bible college lecturer. Stop pretending. And so they pulled me into the experience pool. I thought, oh, I'm not trying to be humble. I really cannot do this. So then me and this inexperienced person walk up to every single person on the campus. Every single person turned us down. Everyone, you know, hi, you know, we're from the local church. We've got a mission coming up. Would you like to talk about Jesus? No. That's it. No. So 20 out of 20 no's. Every other pair comes back, you know, oh, it was amazing. We saw the heavens open, Satan falling down like a dragon from the sky. You know, they get like 20 out of 20 yes responses. So obviously it's not the people, it's us. We're the problem. We don't have the gifting. And my friends who are good at it, they just say to me, it's your body language, Sam. It's your body language. You're wrecking it. You're hopeless at this. It's your body language. Already you're telling them, you don't want to be doing this. So, but I can't fix what my body is doing. So I get 20 out of 20 no's. I've had no positive one-on-one story I can share with you because I get no's all the time. These other people, they can give you 20 good stories out of 20. My minister is amazing. I've just watched him in action. So one time we did a a martial arts thing together. Then we hung out at a coffee shop. Three other people from the class sat down on a table, three women. Two were Jews, so anti-Christian. One was definitely not a Christian. There, and then this, my minister is doing one-on-one evangelism on them in a very sensitive, appropriate, gifted way. So all I'm saying is some of us have the gift, some of us don't. Not that we shouldn't try it, but at the same time realise some of us have a gift and some of us don't. So I actually have no positive one-on-one story to give. Hopefully one day God will give me one. But for those of you who don't have a positive one-on-one story, you're in very good company with me. Those of you who do, you're probably horrified and I've just lost all credibility. And finally, like, this guy just talked on evangelism for the last 2 hours. I should have been giving the talk on evangelism. That's what you're thinking right now. And yes, you should have been. But we all have different giftings and different ways, I think, of telling people about Jesus. My wife, again, terrible at one-on-one, but just amazing with this hospitality thing. And I'm good at upfront, but again, not so good at one-on-one. That's all I can say without being a hypocrite. Yeah.
You're talking about the private and public, secular, and so when people ask you what do, you always say something like about the Bible and Jesus, and then there's that awkwardness, or do you sometimes say something very, you know?
Yeah, so the question is, when people ask you what you do for a living, do I always say I teach about Jesus from the Bible, or do you say something different? I think it's different each and every time. So I think sometimes if I think I want to see how far I can push this, and maybe this is a very good evangelistic opportunity, I try to be really explicit. I teach about Jesus from the Bible, and often it goes well. Sometimes I think, okay, this just doesn't seem to be the right time and place right now, so I say I'm a public speaker, but you know, that's only moving. Then they go, what do you talk on? Okay, I talk about Jesus from the Bible. So sometimes I say I'm a doctor, and I see where that goes. But I found more often than not, if I try to avoid it by saying I'm a doctor, I'm a public speaker, it actually ends up being more awkward, because sooner or later they do find you, your guy who talks about Jesus from the Bible. So for me, I've actually found it works out easier if I just put it out there right from the start. I talk about Jesus from the Bible, and this just happened to me just 2 days ago. Again, it's my wife. I come back from work and the place is full of families from school. She's invited all the parents home from school. And again, this proves the point. So one family, they're from India. Husband, wife, two children. They've just moved into Sydney. No network of friends. This guy's trying to latch onto me. He wants a workout buddy. He wants a drinking buddy. He wants an eating buddy. He wants a moving buddy. He's got no Friday night buddy. And he's trying to see what I'm doing on a Friday night. He's actually sussing, can we hang out tonight on a Friday night? And I'm saying, oh, no. Well, unfortunately, it didn't work. But then he goes, well, what do you do for work? I said, I talk about Jesus from the Bible. Oh, he got so excited. So then that fast-tracked it. He talked about his Hindu faith, and I'm listening. So I guess that's a long way of saying I would love to have 5 or 10 different answers depending on the situation, but I found every time I try to say something different, I've just made it harder. I may as well just begin with saying I teach about Jesus from the Bible, and immediately I can then see their response, then I know where they're coming from, then I can know what to say next. Yes, question.
Sam, I'm not sure in this group here whether there's about 70% white Caucasians.
Uh-huh.
I'm just sort of trying to think, like, the culture where you're talking about connecting with people, having hordes over to your place, whether that sort of is the situation that, like, we aspire to or we're challenged by. But I'd like you at least to sort of speak into the point about where we're trying to engage with people. Can you speak into the areas of, like, courage, fear and rejection that might be going on in our head as we're encouraged by you to sort of, you know, push ourselves a bit with maybe connecting with people?
Yes, so we've heard a lot about the hospitality side, but maybe that's not our gifting, or it's not our circumstances where we can do that. It's not our culture. But what about the fear, courage, and there's a third word?
Rejection.
How do I speak into that? I think by nature most of us are people pleasers, so there's a spectrum of task orientated versus people orientated. Most of us are down towards the people orientated rather than task orientated. And evangelism definitely sends us down task orientated. I need to tell this person about Jesus. And most of us are people orientated. I want to be a people pleaser. I want to placate. I want to be a peacemaker. And so we find it very hard. And then what do I deal with the fear, rejection and...
actually, courage.
Courage. Okay, courage, fear and rejection. You know, we had a really helpful thing in our staff meeting where we talked about conflict resolution. The reason why conflicts never get resolved at work because we're too afraid to confront someone about something. So we actually had to have this person come in and say, you need to bring these things up with workers. You can't triangulate. You've got to actually bring whatever your grievance is to the person that you work with. That's what leads to a peaceful work environment. And then we had to brainstorm what stops you from doing this. And it comes down to we're people pleasers, we're afraid of rejection, we're conflict averse, we don't have the courage. So then she says, yes, and that's fear, and fear is a natural thing. But then fear is actually what allows you to perform. You actually have to harness fear and anxiety. There's that fear, anxiety, performance curve. Not enough, you're not going to perform too much and now you're going to underperform. You got to see this as a good thing. We've been wired this way and the fear is a good thing. Harness it. And then learn to recognize the physiological things stopping you. I know it sounds so basic in what we teach our children, but some slow breathing first, slow your heart rate down, and it's not as confronting as you thought it was, and then do the whole detective thing. What are you afraid of happening? So what are your negative outcomes that you're afraid of? But what are the positive outcomes? And what are your positive thoughts? If I go to this person, what are my positive, happy thoughts? I'll be able to tell them about Jesus. They probably won't reject me. There's a 2 out of 3, maybe a 4 out of 5 chance they already believe in a supernatural God. They already pray in some way. They already believe in life after death. And maybe we can have a deeper, meaningful conversation about something that's important in both our lives. So I think if we do that and just start thinking, okay, I can do this. Fear is a normal, natural response. I've been wired by God to be a people pleaser, but that's okay. Control my physiology, some deep breaths, and now investigate the positive, happy outcomes of what might happen. And more often than not, we'll be surprised by how well that conversation went. So although I'm not very good at the one-on-one, because it always fails at my, would you like to talk about Jesus? But no. When I do have one-on-one conversations, you know, you think 99% of the time, maybe 100% of the time, it always goes well. It always goes well. So then harness that detective thought, what are the positive outcomes? What will most likely happen? Well, most likely, it's going to go well. So let's go ahead and do it. And right now, this fear, this feeling in my stomach, that's a natural thing. And use it for good rather than for evil. Thanks. Yes, question at the back.
Yeah, could you speak into what occurs or how to respond when you've obviously alienated people? My siblings,
yeah.
So it's not like I regularly get to see them or hang out or anything. But, you know, at the times when I have seen them recently, I thought, right, you know, I'm really going to try, I'm going to share my testimony. And they just like completely put the wall down.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to hear, stop, please stop, I don't want to hear anything you're saying. They're nominal Catholic, raised Catholic, but
Yeah.
And I think it's because I've been too full on and overwhelming. And how do you get back to ground?
Yeah, so what do we do with friends and especially family who aren't Christian, and maybe we've even alienated them already with our evangelism attempts in the past? Well, so there's been an alienation. So first of all, the most basic things are reconciliation. So just say, hey, listen, let's clear it. There's an elephant in the room. I've alienated you. This is my behaviour. This is how, is there, you know, they teach you marriage counselling. This is how I must feel from you. This is how you see it. This is how I've hurt you. And so I really want to clear the air and say, I'm sorry for those things. This is what it's done to you. This is how it's hurt you. Will you forgive me? And maybe we can start again. I actually had a friend do this to me formally about a month ago. Like, he's a Christian friend. There was a perceived hurt and he invited me to his place and he said, listen, we need to sit down. I've hurt you. I've alienated you. And on the one hand, I didn't think he had hurt me that much, but it was really, really powerful. And it got me thinking, wow, I need to do that to all these people I've had in my life. So it's got me thinking, this is really, really powerful. So the whole, the reconciliation. So I think we need the reconciliation first. Secondly, again, just be realistic about, this is what happens with close friends and family. Our faith becomes the elephant in the room that is awkward, because worldview is what's so close, what's so tight. And when we conflict on worldview, it's almost hard to have a relationship. So again, back to that interest, values, world thing, it's easy to find common interests. It's easy to find common values, but common worldview is what forms lasting friendships. And if we don't have a common worldview, this is why, you know, Christian, non-Christian marriages are often doomed to fail, because, yeah, you might enjoy the same movies, interests, you might have the same values of how you want to raise your children, but in the end you're going to conflict on the deepest thing, the worldview, and that's where we're having a falling out with our family. There's no silver bullet answer. I'm often encouraged by 1 Peter, where he talks about believing wives married to unbelieving husbands. It says you can win them over without words. I think what it's saying there is they already know what you believe, so that no amount of words is going to add to them knowing what we believe. So maybe we've done the words bit. It's not saying don't do words, but we've done the words bit. They know what we believe. So now it's time to win them over without words. Maybe again by showing wisdom and love. And again, we can love people we don't agree with. So there's a distinction in the Bible. So Jesus eats with tax collectors and sinners. He certainly doesn't approve of their lifestyle, but he has fellowship with them. And I often flip around. Someone said, you know, when he as a Christian got baptized, his atheist, anti-Christian uncle turned up to his baptism. And at no stage does my friend think, my uncle's now a convert believing in Jesus. No, but he's just turned up out of a loving reconciliation thing to do. And I think we can also be reconciled and love and eat with our non-believing family, even if we don't agree with them and they don't agree with us. We're not approving of their non-Christian lifestyle. We're just showing love and reconciliation. So we can win them over without words. But then someone said to me, the other thing is pray, and more than just pray, it's that verse that Jesus says, the harvest is plentiful, pray that God sends people. So we have to pray that God sends other Christians into their lives now besides just us. Thanks. No worries. Yes?
So talking about strategies and intentionality and you know, thoughtful what to do, maybe is it helpful to comment about like genuineness, sincerity, rather than just kind of faith going through,
So talking about investing in these relationships, but what's the tension between being genuine and sincere and wanting to be their friend versus being fake and using them because you want to bring someone to the kingdom? Yes, so it's all about what is the point of having this relationship. And so we can under-invest in a relationship and we can over-invest in a relationship. So under-invest is, you know, here's a chance for a relationship and we're not taking it. Really, we should hang out with them, be their friend, be a go-to person. But if we over-invest, now we're only using the relationship to get them to become a Christian. And at some stage, now you've over-invested. So I think it's getting that sweet spot. I don't want to under-invest, but I don't want to over-invest. So I'll share with you our non-Christian neighbours. So we've gone to their things, they've come to our things, they've come to our family services, our Christmas services. But at some stage, after about 3 or 4 Christmas services, they stop coming. So what do you do? Do you keep trying to get them to come? No, at that stage now you're over-investing, I think, because they've given it a shot, they've heard the gospel, they've heard it 3 or 4 times. Now you can keep on winning them over without words. They see the wisdom in your life, the way you genuinely love and care for them. I think that's it, knowing that they didn't go to church, but you still love and care for them. I think that's the right sweet spot. If you still keep trying to get them to come to your Christmas service, I think you've over-invested at that moment. And what you got to realize is, okay, God, I've planted the seed. I'm one of many moments and events in this person's journey. I pray that now you bring the next person. But in the meantime, I'll still be very available in this person's life. And if they want me as a friend, I will be a friend. And then who knows what happens? Because on our street, we had tragedy happen. And suddenly a lot of the neighbors came to our place for coffee to unwind and debrief. And that's when they do say things like, well, how do you explain this. So they say in official closed countries, that's often how missionaries have to work. You make friendships, you build the networks, don't overinvest in these friendships, but come a time when people recognise the wisdom in your life, they will then come to you rather than the other way around. Yes?
I liked your approach talking about the relational and long-term and it's a journey, and I lean toward that a lot. Do you think there's ever a moment where you kind of do have to push people over a line?
Mm-hmm.
I can think of a friend who was coming to church for 2.5 years and really probably was a Christian, but just getting that push. How do you balance it?
Yeah, it's tricky. What do you do with is there time to push someone? What happens when you push? Someone's been coming along for 2 years. No one's pushed them yet. Really, someone should push them. But what happens if it all goes horribly wrong? Then what happens? Again, just wisdom. There's no right or wrong thing to do. Just timing, trusting God's sovereignty in all of this, and there are times and places for everything. So ironically, the less invested you are in someone's life and the less of a friend they are, ironically, the more you can push. Because if it all goes horribly wrong, you've lost nothing. You're never going to see them again. But the more someone is part of your life and the more you invest in this friendship, ironically, the less you feel comfortable pushing, because if this goes wrong, you lose this person. And now they might never even want to be your friend again. It becomes this awkward elephant in the room. So I like to push gently, 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 gently. And with all my friends who become Christians, somehow, I don't know, they just become a Christian without me pushing. It eventually makes sense for them. I'm not saying not to do it. But I have this other friend, my missionary friend in China, who is just amazing. He can push you to that point. So one time we were on college mission, going to Cootamundra. We fill up our petrol for our car in Mudgee. We pay behind the counter. The woman says, "Oh, what are you guys all doing here?" We said, "We're on a Bible college mission." And then my friend says to her, "Do you go to a church?" And she goes, "I used to go to a church." "Oh, really? What happened?" "Oh, my son died. There was a tragedy, and I don't think the church handled it very well." "Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. Would you like us to pray for you right now?" And she said, "Yes." So somehow he's gone from values, no, interest to values to worldview, and praying with her in 2 minutes, like in the time it takes for you to pay your petrol. And I think that was appropriate for the time. He's got the gifting for it. He did it very sensitively. So I think there's a time and place for everything. But I think the struggle you're having with, this is a close friend, and you've invested in this friendship, and it could be the elephant in the room. So again, it's a wisdom thing. I remember I had a close friend. I went through a youth group with this person, and then he stopped going to church. So finally I had basically having a DTR, define the relationship moment, with this person, just like you have with a girl, and it could go all horribly wrong. I think that's what it is. You're having a DTR with this person about God. So I met with him over dinner. It was really awkward. Like, it was really awkward, because I think we both knew why we were there. And then I said, "Hey, listen, you haven't been coming to church for a while. Would you like to talk about what's going on?" And he shared, you know, he's left the faith. It was true. Like, he's no longer Christian, doesn't believe in God, doesn't believe in Jesus. And then the rest of the dinner was so awkward. It's like proposing to a girl. She says no, but he's still got 3 courses to go through. What do you do now? So you really should wait till dessert, but now there's not enough time to talk about it. So it's that dilemma. And so we had this thing. It was the most awkward, painful dinner I've ever had. It wasn't even with a girl breaking up. It was a guy who I'd been a Christian best friend with, who now is no longer Christian. And so we actually did not see each other the next 20 years. It was that awkward. But then, 2 years ago, he sends me an email out of the blue. He says, "I need to catch up. We need to talk. And I think I want to come back to the faith." So it's one of those things where you don't know how God is going to use your conversation. It could blow up, and it might, but maybe it's just a little seed that will stay in that person's heart for the next 20 years. So it's a wisdom thing. Yeah. Okay.
So to ask about your merging of universities idea, and given that most of us, so we've got our Christian friends, we tend to work in different workplaces, live in different neighbourhoods, so we might have a birthday party or something and invite different groups of people, but people often like to stick with their own people, or even if they do have a few polite conversations across the boundaries, they know that they probably won't see those people again, so that's that. How do you actually get a merge Is it about finding in your workplace other Christians and then you've got your automatic team there rather than having people who are in different worlds that aren't going to have that frequent unplanned contact?
Yeah, so the question is, how do you merge these universes? We have so many universes anyway. And it seems when you try to merge, people don't want to make new friends anyway. And that's that life stage thing. So they do talk about in that New York Times article on friendships. There's this moment, and it happens around 25 or 30, where you close shop. That's it. I've got enough friends. I don't want to make any more friends. I just want to invest in the few I have. And that is what the nature of friendship is anyway. You're trying to feel safe with people that you know very well. So in the instant, you bring a stranger into this circle. Now, oh, we have to abstract back up to small talk. You know, how's the weather? What did you do on the weekend? But if you can be with close people, then we can have the worldview conversation. So that's part of the struggle. We're working against what people might want from a friendship. So my advice is, I think human beings, we're always in this tension between two things. Jonathan Haidt describes it as we're either drawbridge up or we're drawbridge down. Sometimes we're drawbridge up. I don't want any new things happening in my life. I don't want any change. I want things to stay the same. Sometimes we're drawbridge down. I need to welcome more change, more people into my life. And right now he says we're seeing when the Western world, we've gone drawbridge up. That's why Brexit has just happened. Donald Trump is drawbridge up. We don't want any immigrants in our society. There have been phases in our life we've been drawbridge down. We want change. And people are the same in their private world. So I think you just tread gently, softly, and organically. So just like the farmer sowing the seeds, organically, some goes on the path, some goes on the soil, some goes on the rocks, and some goes on good soil. You invest in these multiple universes, but you don't know which one's going to organically flourish. It's an art rather than a science. There is no magic formula. So we invested very heavily, I think, into the swimming one. Nothing happened. Like, we invited people back. But really, the playgroup and the AFL one is the one that's, I think, slowly flourishing. I think, again, for us, it's been unnatural because we're dealing with people with no network in their lives. They moved into Sydney in the last 2 to 5 years. So for us, that's been a little bit easier. But I think, again, if you just... It takes 2 years for these networks to work. And that's why we don't see it immediately. But if bit by bit, we hang out together, do things together and eat together, I think these networks organically form. We can't force them. They just happen organically. And we can just make it happen, hopefully provide a safe environment and pray that God will do his thing and form these networks. Yes?
I just wanted to go back to something you were saying about, you know, it takes wisdom. And I'm curious about that, I suppose, in relation to, when I ask, is there any scope for wisdom to be informed by the Holy Spirit's guidance in interactions with people? A clue, you know, something, or an opportunity we take, or
So the question's on wisdom, the role of the Holy Spirit and guidance. So wisdom, I love wisdom. So the more and more I read the Bible, I realize there's a category of true versus false. There's a category of ethics, right versus wrong. But there's a category of what I've suddenly realized is wisdom. And you see that in the Bible in Proverbs where it deliberately puts two conflicting verses next to each other. One verse says, answer a fool according to their folly. Next verse, don't answer a fool according to their folly. And think, well, which one is it? Suddenly you realize there is no right or wrong, true or false answer. You need wisdom now to work this out. And like you say, wisdom's fuzzy. It's subjective. It's a guidance thing. It's a Holy Spirit thing. And I think the Bible then says, well, really, all you can do is fear the Lord. That's the beginning of wisdom. Be in tune with God, because God's in tune with what's happening in his world. So it's almost like by being in tune with God, then you'll have the wisdom to be in tune with what's going on in the world. But I think don't beat yourself up then if you get it wrong. And even in the secular world, they say you need 20 failures for one success. Apparently that's the ratio. So now in the secular business world, they say, well, don't be afraid to fail. Because if you're not failing enough, you're not going to succeed. So Google now deliberately giving employees 1 day a week off just to go experiment. so they can get their failures out of the way sooner rather than later. So they say, if you're going to fail, do it quickly and try another thing. So I think don't beat ourselves up for when we do get it wrong. Like the farmer shouldn't beat himself up for, oh, you know, look, that went on the path. Well, you gave it a go. You know, it didn't work out. You gave it a go. And same for us. So knowing that it's subjective, it's a guidance thing, and we're not going to have really clear markers. All I can do is be in tune with God and hope that puts me in tune with what's happening in the world. Someone, I remember a family systems counsellor says, basically one of the keys to wisdom in life is thinking, what is my responsibility and what can I control? So don't beat yourself up for not being able to control something that you shouldn't have been able to control and take on a responsibility you shouldn't have been able to take on. I'll give you an example. At my church, at morning tea, kids run everywhere. Like we have two or three services, they're 200 each, so on the morning there are 400, 600 people on the lawn, too small for us. Kids just run everywhere. So, you know, in sport, like in netball, basketball, soccer, football, you can play man-on-man defence and that's effective, but it's unsustainable because you've got to chase your opponent around for the whole game. So they invented zone defence. It's only when a person comes into your zone, that's your person, but when they leave your zone, that's not your person, not my responsibility, not in my control. So morning tea, I could chase after my three little boys, man-on-man defence, or I just play zone. I just stand in this spot. If my boy comes in my zone, I'll look after him. Oh, he's left my zone. He's someone else's problem. And a lot of life is knowing what is in my zone. So as a doctor, nurse will always ring you up and say, oh, we've got a broken hand. I say, did you say hand? I'm on for feet tonight. You know, so it's not my responsibility. And saying, so what is in my responsibility as a Christian and what can I control? And I'll just do the best as I can given that responsibility, given what I can control in evangelism. I thought there was a question here, and then I'll go. Yeah.
For those with very little storytelling skills,
yeah.
What are some good ways to grow in that skill?
Okay, those of us with little storytelling skills, how can we grow in those skills? So I pointed to Christine Dillon, Wycliffe course. I listen to the Moth Radio Hour on a podcast as much as I can. Where's my pen? And just listen to them. And you're right, even these guys have been coached. To get onto the Moth, you've got to ring up, pitch your story. And they actually come and then help you write your story. So there is a science behind it. So again, don't beat ourselves up. Oh, I'm not a storyteller. Why can't I be like one of these Moth storytellers? Well, they've had coaching. Someone's actually helped them do it. But on the other hand, it's something that just happens naturally. I think we all grew up knowing how to tell stories and it just got beat out of us by the university system, you know, lectures and PowerPoint slides, and we forgot how to do it. I think it's like kids, they can paint really well, then we beat it out of them, and then if they're lucky enough, they can paint like a kid again, and then their things end up in museums, because it's just what we end up doing naturally and organically. But what can I say? Basically, I'll give you this little thing I've discovered, and you preachers can learn the same thing. The key is you've got to have two twists in your story. You got to have say something, and you got to have the word but appear once. And if you're really lucky, you get the word but to appear a second time. Now you have a story. Until then, you only had an event. So a story has to have the word but come up once, maybe twice. I'll give you an example. Let's say I was preaching, and I'll give you this illustration. We went to a wedding a few years ago, and our little boy Cooper, no matter how much we tried to get him to dress up, instead, he wore shorts, rubber gum boots, and a red singlet. All right, so that's an event. So it's just going to produce polite laughter. It's like me showing a spinning bow tie. Look, I've got a bow tie. It's spinning. Laugh, please. Look, my boy's in shorts and gum boots. Laugh, please. It's not funny. It's just an event. It happens. But I tell you this way. We went to a wedding. Now, at a wedding, the convention is everyone needs to dress up. So guys, suit, tie, shirt with a collar. But, there's your first bun, no matter how much we tried, we couldn't get our son Cooper, our four-year-old, to dress up. Instead, he wore a red singlet, shorts, and rubber gumboots. But, when we got there, everyone's looking at Cooper saying at the wedding, look at Cooper. Look what he's wearing. Good on him for wearing what he wanted to wear. And suddenly every parent is thinking, why can't we just have let our kids wear what they wanted to wear? And every guy's looking at his wife, why didn't you let me wear shorts to the wedding? See, now you have a story. Because actually there was an introduction at a wedding. You're meant to dress up. There's a mission. But this is your first crisis. Our kid is not dressing up. But when we get there, everyone's saying, hey, look at Cooper. That's your resolution. And so for the preachers out there, that's the key to sermon illustration. Not how funny the story is, but can I get the word but into my illustration twice? And that's the key to good sermon illustration. And so that'll be the first thing. Is there drama? Is it just an event, or is there drama? Is there a plot line? Basically, by having drama, now you have a plot. Now you have purpose. Now you have direction. And storytelling is so powerful because when you tell a story, you're forcing the listener to suspend disbelief and see the world through your eyes. They actually have to momentarily adopt the worldview of the storyteller. And so I was sharing during the break, I was listening to The Moth on the way down to Canberra. They had this scientist share his story of how he lived in a boat, trawling the ocean depths, studying the ocean, and there were fish and there was life down there. But he went back 20 years later and now the ocean's dead. Where there was life, there used to be life. It's dead, it's all gone. The fish are gone, the life is gone. But now they've declared some oceans to be wildlife sanctuaries. And wherever they've preserved the ocean as sanctuaries, the life is coming back. So he's giving you a story, not just him on a boat, but he's actually preached to you an evangelistic message that we need to preserve oceans as wildlife parks. And at the end, everyone's on their feet clapping him. So somehow he's actually converted you to his worldview through just telling a story. And I think as Christians, we need to now learn how to tell stories. And, you know, and let me share with you. Everyone says this. You go to the Christian blogs. Everyone says, we need to tell stories. And there's just this latest blog. There aren't enough non-university people in our churches. We need to tell stories. And they say that until you give them stories. And suddenly the gatekeepers go, whoa, I don't like this. He didn't tell the gospel, he told a story. And think, well, I think we just got to do more than pay lip service to it. We've got to do it and welcome him. And I think that's what's happened. You have these gatekeepers who learn a certain way and until they hear the gospel a certain way through a didactic, dry propositional statement that they don't recognise the gospel in the story. Thanks. Okay, question. Yeah, it's interesting now we're in the West because we've gone post-Christian. Oh, sorry, the question is, do you think Christians should go to events with our non-Christians where it might conflict with our Christian worldview, like a gay wedding or helping a friend navigate their way through an abortion being there in the clinic? So I think what you've asked is actually exposed now that in the West, now that we've gone post-Christian, post-reach, we're facing the same ethical issues that Christians in the non-West have had all along. So Asian Christians in Thailand have this issue, do I go to my parents' funeral where there's going to be ancestor worship? On the one hand, if I go, I maintain relationships, I demonstrate loyalty and I honour my parents, which is very important in the Confucian worldview. But on the other hand, this is idolatry. And idolatry is one of the worst sins in the Old Testament. You know, you get stoned to death for it. What, and now you're in this dilemma. I think it's, again, it's a wisdom thing. It's not a right or wrong, true, false thing. Do you answer a fool according to their folly or do you not answer a fool according to their folly? They're always going to be conflicting principles. It's almost like in ethics, they give you that horrible dilemma. Do you send the train this way to kill your son or do you send the train this way to kill 100 strangers? Or there's a Nazi hiding under your bed and there's a Jew hiding under your bed and a Nazi knocks on the door. Are you hiding a Jew? Do you tell the truth? Or do you tell a lie to save a life? So you're always going to have conflicting principles. This is something you can't answer just based on principles alone because the principles always conflict. I think it's a wisdom question. What is wise? What is unwise? Sometimes the wise thing to do would be to turn up. Sometimes the unwise thing would be not to turn up. So just some guiding principles. I think number one, as I mentioned before, my friend once flipped it around. He's a Christian. He's getting baptized. His non-Christian, atheist, anti-Christian uncle turns up to his baptism walks into a Christian church. What is going on? So how do we interpret the non-Christian uncle's action? Has he converted to Christianity? Is he condoning this worldview that he's so violently outspoken against? Or is he doing something loving and reconciling and honouring this guy and his tradition? Do you know what I mean? And most of us would think at the moment, no, I'm going to interpret the uncle's action as he's actually doing a family thing. He's just doing something very loving, turning up to my friend's baptism. He hasn't converted to Christianity. He still is an atheist. He's still anti-Christian. So then we flip around. Sometimes as Christians, we can turn up to non-Christian events, which are very outspokenly anti-Christian. And then it's, what is our action? How is it being interpreted? At this moment, am I condoning what's going on? Am I agreeing with what's going on? Or am I being loving and trying to maintain a relationship? Jesus, I think, had the same issue. He was always criticized for eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners. When he eats with them, is he condoning them? Is he agreeing with their lifestyle? No, he's not. But somehow he's in fellowship with them. And I think we can distinguish between love and fellowship and agreeing and approving. So as long as we can maintain that distinction, I think it's okay. But number two, you notice, it comes down to how is our action interpreted? And that's something we can't control. So how does a non-Christian interpret our action? How does a Christian interpret our action? So Paul gives a guiding principle in 1 Corinthians. You know, he says, you can eat food offered to idols. I know we're told not to worship idols, but in there, what is an idol? It's just a piece of wood. It's not really alive. There is no God here. This is just food. Eat it. It's okay. But then some people say, but how would this action be interpreted? Is it seen as idol worship? And then Paul says, you know what? In that case, if it's being interpreted that way and your conscience can't handle it, better for you not to eat the food offered to idols. And I think that's our guiding principle. Number one, we can love without having to approve. We can have fellowship without agreeing. But number two, how is this action being interpreted? And that's something that needs wisdom.